So this was meant to be an informal dashboard presentation, but then I started thinking about how to do this, and I realized that the sort of notation requires you to distinguish between different fonts, and so on. There's a lot of pictures, and in the end, I thought I would just prepare slides. The slides are a bit rough because I didn't have a lot of time, but we'll see how it goes. Okay. So where this comes from is in this recent paper, when I was trying to reconstruct quantum theory, I realized I needed a version of quantum theory I wanted to reconstruct, and in particular these sort of old ideas I had, where I had the R and the P representations of states and effects. So there's sort of two different ways of representing the same information. The R is a list of probabilities, the P is a list of probabilities, and the R vector is a kind of dual to that, which can have negative entries. That had already been, I'd sort of taken that idea and put it into the causaloid framework and made it much more sort of rigorous. Into the Dewar-Tensor framework. The Dewar-Tensor framework was motivated by considerations coming from quantum gravity, trying to sort of see how to go about formulating physical theories in a way that doesn't use an evolving state, so that you might be able to deal with indefinite causal structure. Although in the Dewar-Tensor framework, you do have definite causal structure. So there's a sort of different sort of set of ideas that led to this sort of new reconstruction. The new reconstruction is, I would say, strongly related to the quantum Combs approach. There's a sort of a mapping between the objects in it. It's also related to the multi-time approach of Haranoff, Sandu, Lev Weidman, Jeff Dollickson, and the general boundary approach, which is less well known in this community but better known in the quantum gravity community. It's due to Robert Urkel, and it sort of goes back, I think, to sort of older ideas, older formulations of quantum field theory. Just listening to Matt's talk yesterday, I think there's clearly some connections between this and what he was talking about. Although I don't know exactly how to at this stage to say what those connections are. And there's a lot of inspiration coming from the pictorialism of Samson Bransky and Bob Kirker. So here's our outline. I'll just quickly go through the circuit framework once again, since I presented this already on last week on Monday. I don't want to spend much time on that. Then I'll talk about operations. Operations are things in a laboratory. They're single uses of an apparatus and Dewar-Tensor. So how to put operations in this Dewar-Tensor framework. Then I'll talk about operators and Dewar-Tensors. So what's interesting is it turns out that if you look at operators, so these are sort of objects sort of that act on a Hilbert space, then that you can set up a framework that has a very similar structure to the structure of operations. And then I'll bring those two things together and show how to reformulate quantum theory. Okay, so first of all, the circuit framework. So like I said, I want to zip through this as quickly as possible. The basic object is an operation. So this is a single use of an apparatus in a laboratory. It has various features. It has inputs corresponding to whatever systems are going into the operations, electrons, photons, whatever. It has outputs, things that are coming out. Then also it has some classical knob settings, you know, that you choose. And also it has an outcome associated with it. When I specify this is... points at the screen rather than the computer. Implicit in this notation A is a particular outcome, and this is operations take one. What I want to do is talk about operations with coarse graining. So associated with a particular operation, denoted by this symbol A, is a particular outcome set. If we had a different outcome set but for the same apparatus use, we would have a different symbol from A. And we'd have a different outcome set. Okay. And we say that if the outcome is in this outcome set, the operation happens. We can put wires between operations. This sort of corresponds to lining up the apertures.
We have to match the types, and we don't allow closed loops. And then we can connect together a bunch of operations with wires, leaving some inputs and outputs open, possibly. And this general object is called a fragment. The outcome set associated with the fragment is just the Cartesian product of the outcome sets associated with each of the operators, each of the operations. And we say a fragment happens if the outcome is in the outcome set. Okay. And then a circuit is a special case of a fragment that has no open inputs or outputs left over. Oh, and I should draw your attention to this notation. I'm sure you remember it from before. Here, we can represent this sort of situation either diagrammatically or symbolically. And the symbolic representation is just where we have these integers that we put on when we do symbolic representation. And the 4 is repeated. That indicates that there's a wire between these two, from this output to this input. That's this wire here. Okay. Here's a more complicated example. And you can check in this that all the wires correspond to repeated integers. Okay. So we have this basic assumption. We assume that if you take some circuit, then we can associate a probability with that circuit. That's the probability that the outcome is in the outcome set associated with it. In other words, that the outcome here is in the outcome set associated with A, the outcome here is in the outcome set associated with B, here the one associated with C, here the one associated with B, and here the one associated with D. So the probability is just the probability that the outcome is in the outcome set to each of these places. So it's a joint probability. And we assume that this joint probability is independent. So it depends only on the knob settings and the wiring on that circuit, and is independent of anything happening elsewhere, any knob settings or outcomes happening elsewhere. So this is kind of sort of like saying that circuits are kind of closed, and so you can associate a probability with them. This leads to this result. So this is trivial to prove. If you have two circuits like this, then the probability for the combined circuit, regard this total thing as a circuit, is just the product of the probabilities for each circuit. The Pavia group take this factorization as a sort of starting assumption. So that's part one. Good. So part two. So I'm going to talk about operations and Dewar tensors. So those of you that have heard me talk about Dewar tensors before will find this this bit familiar, but not everyone has heard me talk about that. So first of all, I want to define this notion of equivalence for linear sums of fragments. So I start by defining this thing I call the P function, and the P function is defined in just this way. So the P function of a linear sum of circuits is taken to be equal to the corresponding linear sum of the probabilities for those circuits. So this definition makes sense for circuits because circuits have probabilities associated with them. It wouldn't make sense if we had fragments in here. But I'm going to use this to define a notion of equivalence for fragments. So here's an example. Here we have a linear sum of fragments. These are special sorts of fragments in this case that just correspond to a preparation because we have an output. So this linear sum is equivalent to this linear sum if this equation holds. And you can see what I've done here is I've taken some other fragment that completes each term into this linear sum into a circuit. So if you take this and this, you get a circuit because all the wires get matched up and it's closed. And so this thing makes sense. And so this side is equivalent to that if this is true for all possible fragments you could close the thing with. So here's the general definition. We'll write that one expression is equivalent to another expression if this is true, where here this is some fragment that closes the terms in this expression into a linear sum of circuits. Okay. Equivalence is a weaker notion than equality, and I'll show you a good example of that. So we can show that a circuit is equivalent to its own probability. I'm going to keep coming back, keep mentioning that, so I'm just going to write it on the blackboard so you... and the proof is here. So the only thing that could complete a circuit into a circuit is another circuit, because there's no wires to match up, so the only thing you can put next to it is another circuit. So if you consider the P function of some circuit like that, so A times E, well then we have this factorization property that I mentioned earlier, so properties factorize, so this is true. But now, this is just equal to the probability of A, and of course, and this P function is linear, so we can take this bit inside and get this. And now if we look at the definition of equivalence, you can see that this means that A is equivalent to the probability of A. Okay. And the general kinds of equivalence you have are these ones. So you can have, these are the sorts of things you can have that can be equivalent. You can either have a weighted sum of circuits, real number, real coefficients, and also a real number here. This number can sit, so this kind of thing can be equivalent. This sort of expression can be equivalent to this. And, or you can have a linear combination of fragments where each fragment has the kind of same causal structure. That's necessary so that you can find some fragment E that completes them into a circuit. Okay. So the reason I wanted this idea of equivalence sort of starts to come in here now. So for the moment, ignore this black dot. Here I've got a preparation. Okay. I can also write, ignore this italic subscript. It's actually a pre-subscript. So ignore that for the moment. So here I have a preparation. Okay. But actually, I want a set of preparations. I want a set of fiducial preparations. So the set of preparations, in some sense, span the set of possible preparations. So I introduce this integer label that goes from 1 up to some number case of A. Okay. This is a number, an integer associated with the type of system. So here I have a set of fiducial preparations, and I can represent this symbol, this symbolic thing diagrammatically like this. And the reason for this black dot I'll explain. At least it will become clear as I go through. So if we do this, then what it means for this set of preparations to be fiducial is that I can write any preparation for a system of this type as being equivalent to a linear sum of fiducial preparations. So this here, I'm using summation convention over the integer label, and this A here is just a bag of numbers. Okay. So this is what I mean that this set is fiducial, that there exists some set of numbers, some set of coefficients that make this true for any preparation. And then I can write this symbolically just by saying that the preparation is equivalent to this object. And what this means, this horizontal line means, is it means that we're summing over the index. Is that clear?
I'll explain later. Yeah. It's useful to introduce the white and black. So if you don't like the white and black, I'm going to define this to be true. And so this is more conventional sort of like Penrose diagrammatic notation. Use some other distributed integer. Okay.
Good. So now I'm going to do the same thing, exactly the same thing for fiducial results. So this is all the same, but notice there's a slightly different position for the integer label. I should also have pointed out that the importance of the font. So sans serif font is used for types. It's also used for operations, whereas the regular italics maths font is used for this integer label. Okay, so everything here is essentially the same. I call the things that are sort of like the time inverse of results, preparations, I call those results. It's the same thing that the Pavia group call observations. Is that right? Yeah. And maybe that's a better name for it. I don't know. So results end up corresponding to effects. So you can do the same thing. You get this set of coefficients that make this work. Okay. So you can do this. Call this a simple tango. Start off with a simple circuit here, and now I can insert in the equivalent things. Of course, I can just remove the black and white dots as I defined that you could. And now I can use the linearity of the p function to say that this is equivalent to this, where I've taken. So here I've got. I'm defining this object, which I call the hopping metric, to be equal to the probability that you get for each fiducial preparation followed by fiducial result. So this is this is basically a matrix, a sort of K sub A by K sub A matrix. Okay. So with this definition, we have this. And also, given this thing I wrote down here, that a circuit is equal to its is equivalent to its probability, we can also write down that each of the circuits here, for each labels, each pair of labels here and here, is equivalent to the probability. So this is true.
Like the same small a on.
Yeah, well, if I write this down symbolically, then I would put a different label here, A1 and A2.
Okay.
But because it's on a diagram, I can see these are in different places. I know they have to be different.
Okay. Yeah. So I shouldn't think of them as things.
So they have to be different labels. Right. This, you know, this A just tells you that's the kind of label that sits here.
Okay.
What associated with a system of type A. And this tells you that, just like in the previous notation, I needed the integers in the symbolic representation, but not in the diagrammatic representation, because I just see physically where the wires are.
I see.
Okay. 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 Black and white dots. So now you start to see what the black and white dots can do for you. So I can define this. So I can say, well, if I
take the hopping metric and put it on one of these things, so this is here I'm summing, of course. Then this is equivalent to this thing, where I've now changed the color of the dot, and the same over here. So what this actually does for you is this is a sort of a set of coefficients with the white dot. Actually, when you have black dots, when you have all black dots on an object, it becomes a set of probabilities. I'm not sure I'll have time to explain why that is the case. So we have something like this, which we had on the previous slide. So take this diagram. We have something like this. Well, just using these definitions, I can write this down in different forms. And then I can define that to just be equivalent to having a wire with no black and white dots on it. And there's no ambiguity because I can just simply, I can use these equations, these identities, I suppose. I can insert black and white dots as many times as I want in either order and get either of these things back. And this is consistent. So you can insert and delete pairs of black and white dots in any order as you like. And this is consistent as long as you define, as long as you say that the object with two white dots is the inverse of the hopping metric, and then the object with one black dot and one white dot, there are two like that, are each equal to the identity. And then you get consistency. Okay. So this is just repeating what I said previously. So we can write this is equal to that. Then that's equivalent. So this is equivalent to this, which is equivalent to that. And then just by definition, that's equal to that. So we can cancel over black and white dots. So since we have this equation, the probability for any circuit, now we have a circuit consisting of A and B. A circuit is equivalent to its probability. That means that the probability associated with this circuit is just equal to this expression because this is equivalent to that. Is that clear? Any questions? Okay. So now my second assumption. This assumption is equivalent to the assumption of local tomography. In some ways it's more compelling. In some ways it's less compelling. It depends on your point of view. What's more compelling about it is it's kind of a sort of a local assumption for each operation. What's less compelling is that it's more complicated. is slightly more complicated to understand than state. So what we say is the operations are, so the assumption is the operations are fully decomposable. This means that any operation can be written as being equivalent to a linear sum, let me read this here, a linear sum of operations, each of which consists of a fiducial result, sorry, of a result and a preparation. Sorry, in words we say that any operation is equivalent to a linear combination of operations, each of which consists of a result for each input and a preparation for each output. Okay. Does this diagram make sense? It's just, this is a bunch of coefficients, and here we're summing over fiducial results for each input, fiducial preparations for each output. And this is true in quantum theory. It's true in complex quantum theory. Actually, it's not true in real quantum theory, which, obviously, since this is equivalent to local, it's not equivalent. Yeah.
Let's just consider type matching. If this sort of thing would have to be equivalent to something like this,
well, then clearly you'd have to have you have to have wires coming in here into results, and you'd have to have preparations going out here, because this thing consists of a bunch of inputs. Here's the inputs, a bunch of outputs. Maybe I haven't answered your question.
Maybe I can just say here's a simple example is where this bunch of coefficients just has one entry.
Well, it was a zero. So then here's an example of an operation. I just need this is an operation. Some systems come in. I have some results, and then some systems go out for some preparations. Yeah, sort of. Yeah, but then exactly. It's a linear combination all over fiducial measure and prepares.
Except, and these things can be negative. That's how you
can get to the full set of operations. Okay. Right. What I could do is I can reinsert in this diagram some black and white dots. So I have black dots next to the fiducial elements. And then this just tells you that this object here is the weights in the sum of fiducial elements. And this is an example of a Dewar tensor. So what are Dewar tensors in general? They're like tensors, except that they have a bit more structure. Each index is associated with two basis choices, one for fiducial results and one for fiducial preparations. So here's another example of a Dewar tensor. You can write that in symbolic notation like this. And one thing you can do is you can change the colors of the dots using Hopping metrics or the inverse of a Hopping metric. So here's an example of that. These things transform like tensors, except with respect to two bases. Okay, so those are interesting objects in itself, and they seem like the natural object for these kinds of operational frameworks. And this is sort of the generalization of the RP framework. So in the RP framework, you had p vectors, and p vectors are a list of probabilities. Those are associated with the case where you have all black dots. And you had R vectors, which are kind of analogous to the case where you have all white dots. Except, of course, this is a more general thing because it corresponds to general operations, not just to preparations and effects. Okay. What am I doing? Oh, yeah. All black dots corresponds to... So this is true. I won't prove that. Okay, so now let's consider the advanced tango. So take some circuit. We can take any circuit. Here's an example. And for each element in each operation in this circuit, I'm going to replace it with the thing we get from full decomposability. So here, I replace this one by this object. C has been replaced by this object, and so on, all the way through. Okay, I'm just inserting the thing. So this must be equivalent to this. I am implicitly using the fact that probabilities factorize in this, if you think about it a little bit, because I'm using this equivalence in many different places. But that's a small point. because you can see now what we've actually got is a linear sum of circuits. So here, this object, if you look at the physics, so the mathematics is in these things and these links, but the physics is just here. This is a circuit. It's just a circuit containing a fiducial preparation and a fiducial effect. So we've basically taken a more complicated circuit and reduced it to a linear sum over circuits consisting only of a preparation and a result. So that's kind of where this power comes from in this approach. Okay. Yeah, so let me just go through a few steps. So this is equal to that. This is graphically the same thing, so therefore equal. So this remains equivalent. I've just changed the shape in order to make the next step more transparent. But now, remember that the Hopkin metric was this thing, so we have that this is equivalent to that. So if we take this thing again, and now insert black and white dots appropriately. So a white dot, for example, we've got a white dot and a black dot, a black dot and a white dot, and now we can insert the Hopkin metric, because that was equivalent, in here. And so now we have that this is equivalent to this. And now this thing, we can cancel over the black and white dots and get this. So if you take the first step and the last step, we have that this is equivalent to that. Okay. Any questions? That's clear. So all this same structure is going to be repeated again when we come to look at the operators. And that's kind of the advantage of this approach.
Kind of what's happened is you converted a physical thing. This is a thing in laboratory description. You converted it through this equivalence, using this equivalence property on its side.
That's what it's ended up doing. And this thing is a number, and this thing is a thing in laboratory. So this is an example like this. Yeah. But it's a sort of tensor, or a dual tensor circuit. But when if you do the maths here, you get a number. Okay. So it's an example of a circuit being equivalent to its own probability. Yeah. So it's interesting that the structure of the structure you see in the laboratory is maintained in the structure you see in the calculation.
Is a matrix of some of
yeah matrix. But you have the same at the beginning, right? So you already have these indices up and down.
The indices don't correspond to labels. They're just telling you what types
you
have.
Because
this box here is just a representation of something in the laboratory. So this says that you have electrons coming out. Electrons don't have integers. They're physical things. So this is physics and this is maths. You turn physics into maths. It's sort of what's happening.
Why are you so interested in keeping the difference between these two levels? Okay, we just identify our math and say, okay, when I see these matrices, this just corresponds to.
Well, I think it's healthy to distinguish. When you do some physics, to distinguish what bit of it corresponds to the description of the world, what bit of it corresponds to the calculation you do to make a prediction. These things are not equal, they're equivalent.
Equivalence and equality are very different notions, because,
The right hand side, essentially.
We can talk about the benefits of this, I think it's a healthy thing, right?
So in the Bob's approach, when he closes off the circuit, that's a scalar.
Right.
So when you say that he's sort of doing what Giulio is saying, diagram
because for me this thing actually corresponds to representation of something in the laboratory, so it's not scalar. But you go to the laboratory, just have to produce scalars. It's very easy to do experiments, but they have to actually do the experiments. So I think you're right.
Bob is doing exactly what Giulio is. Well, Bob isn't here. I guess last night went on longer than. Okay. So I like this. In fact, I like it some more generally. I like the idea that generally your operational description, you describe the world in a sufficiently precise way, and then you just have a rule for turning that into a calculation. That's a very nice way of doing physics. If you can just go and sort of photograph or more general, because you want time dilution film, your experiment, and then have an algorithm for turning that film into a calculation, then that would be a very nice way to proceed. Okay. Oh, yeah, so of course now I'm just applying this result here. Since we had equivalence between these two sides, that means that the probability for this circuit is equal to this expression. So one thing we can do with this is we can break up circuits into fragments. So we can break a circuit up any old way we want. So here's one example. And then we can turn it on its side. We can break the corresponding Dewar tensor calculation up into fragments with the same shape. Now, you know, we may happen to know the Dewar tensor associated with this fragment, so we don't have to redo the calculation from the basic operations. And then we can put these together in any way. And one of the advantages of this is rather than having to, and normally when you do calculations of circuits, you foliate the circuit, evolve the state forward, and then you calculate the answer. You don't have to foliate. You can just break a circuit in any old way you want into bits that you happen to know the answer for, and then put them back together. So you can put these back together in this calculation and get the answer. Okay, that's part three. Now part four. I'm using the old Roman notation here because I'm more conservative. So now I'm going to set up very much the same structure for operators rather than operations. So the kind of attitude here is almost to regard you have operations in a laboratory. Now you have a place where you keep operators, and I want to turn those into Dewar tensors. So it's sort of a bit similar. The mentality is a bit similar. In the last part, we're going to connect the two things up. So we'll start just by defining Hilbert spaces, and the placing of the types is sort of important. It tells you something about the structure of the objects that we end up getting. So we have these ones with subscripts, and the dimension is given by some integer that depends on the type. And strictly speaking, I should have used a different symbol for the types in this part of the talk. But, you know, there's a limit to how many fonts one wants to introduce. And so I'm using the same. I should have used a different font. But there's a limit to how many fonts one wants to use. So I'm using the same font. So we have these ones. Then we have these ones which have superscripts. We're going to think of these ones as corresponding to these ones that correspond to kind of result operators. These ones will end up corresponding to preparation operators. You see, basically, this is the same Hilbert space. It's just the difference is in the structure on the type label. And then more generally, we can define a Hilbert space like this. And this is just the tensor product of all the Hilbert spaces that that you get from these subscripts and superscripts. And incidentally, I'm always assuming that we have complex Hilbert spaces. So now I'm finding this to be the space of Hermitian operators acting on this Hilbert space. So I'm not sure, I never remember exactly what the best notation is here. So L with these subscripts and superscripts is the space of Hermitian operators that act on the Hilbert space I just defined. So I'm slowly building up this structure. Now what we can do is we can represent an element that lives in this space, or that acts on that Hilbert space. So we can represent it like this, so either diagrammatically like this, or symbolically like this. You'll see just a few things have changed. So now I have a hat, and I've also changed the font, because this is actually, after all, a mathematical object. Okay, so I have a hat living on here, and if you want this to indicate it's an operator. And over here, again, I have the hat, and the normal mass font, and I have a double line to indicate that this is an operator, not an operation. Okay, so here, now some notation. Imagine we want to consider two of these objects, so something like this. Well, normally, if you consider two of these things, you put a tensor product symbol in. But instead of doing that, I'm just going to write it like this. I don't need to put the tensor product symbol in because all the information that the tensor product symbol would convey is conveyed in the fact that I have two different integers here. And that tells me everything I need to know. In actual fact, the tensor product symbol ends up being obstructive if you put it in. so it's better not to. So I can write, that instead of that. Likewise, I write this. Notice I have two different labels, two different integers here. So I write this instead of that. Here I have the same type, but again, two different labels, two different integers. So I write that instead of that. This thing, for example, would correspond to I have A D, yeah. So the order isn't important. All the information is in integers, so I can write this in either order. That's one of the advantages of not using the tensor product symbol.
I mean, I've just introduced I just introduced us. So what I'm showing you is just an example of this
model. Oh, okay, so I was thinking H was sort of the space.
So the space this thing acts on is this space of permission operators. Okay. If we have, so the order isn't important, and this thing is equal to that thing. And then if we have a repeated integer,
then I'm going to, then like we have like this, then this is not equal to the tensor product of those things. We have a repeated integer. That's going to end up corresponding to a wire. And what that means is that we have the product of this operator times this operator. And I'll explain that again in more detail on a future slide.
Brian, okay.
This example corresponds to an operator. Yeah. This operator lives on...
On what? So this is an operator.
This operator lives on
the inner space.
This is an operator on acting on the Hilbert space.
Yes, and then...
And this is acting on a Hilbert space.
And giving just a number.
There's an operator, so it doesn't give a number. So.
No, like an operator then should be an output inner space, right? There's only an input inner space there, right?
Oh, but I've just defined... I mean, this is just mathematics.
I've defined these Hilbert spaces, and here I've got subscripts and superscripts. I can define those. Now, this is just mathematics, really. And now this object, you see, inputs just correspond to subscripts, which I introduced.
One subscript like there. Yeah. Subscript, not bra. Bra. Bra.
What do you mean by bra?
Acts on neighbor space and gives something. Number.
Oh.
And the other is a cat.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, these aren't pure states. They correspond in general to mixed operating, general operators.
Or then it's a trace with...
Well, I think I've defined it sufficiently. I don't think I should define it any further than I have. It's an example of this type of object. And this is an
operator living in this space, which is the space of permission operators acting on here. I'm carrying along with me some structure that comes from these subscripts and superscripts. This may be not the conventional way to proceed, but this structure is kind of useful. It's going to be very useful. You want to think in terms of some of these objects being dual to other of these objects. Whereas I just want to say...
One wire.
And this is an example of something like this. An object like this. It happens to wire coming in and wire going out, but it just happens even like as the tensor product of this thing.
Which is a brand new
case.
One is an operator. So
this one is operator, and the tensor product of the two is the brand new case.
I don't think in this way. If it helps you, you can think more.
Because these are operators acting on Hilbert space. They're not elements of a Hilbert space. Okay.
So this whole thing is, yes. But each of these things individually acts on Hilbert space. So this isn't a bra. This isn't an element of a Hilbert space. This is an operator. Does it? I mean, it's not
the dual
I don't need to say anything about whether it's a dual or not, because I've defined this object sufficiently already, so I don't think I need to talk about duals between these objects. Maybe you can say that some of those objects are dual of us. So I suppose if one object matches the other, the wiring can match, then it could be, you could say it was dual, but I don't think I need to say that. Okay, so that's the notation. So again, we can talk about fiducial operators. So now we've introduced a spanning set of operators. So the same sort of notation before, except with the obvious changes. In the case of, you know, because we have complex Hilbert space, this k will be equal to n squared, where n is the dimension. So,
and I'm tending to think of these things as corresponding to positive operators, so a spanning set of positive operators corresponding to this case. And here we have, so this is for results, and this is for preparations. Okay. So it's the same structure as before. Okay. Well, since the Hilbert spaces are complex, we have this property, that the space of Hermitian operators, so that shouldn't be a, that doesn't need to be a definition, actually. That should just be equal. Is equal to the tensor product. That's one of the beautiful things about complex Hilbert spaces. So we have this result. We have that an operator can be fully decomposed into fiducial operators like this. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions? No. Notice here we have equality rather than equivalence, because these are already linear objects. We don't need to sort of talk about things being equivalent.
This notation with the double box
yeah.
and the previous one.
Right.
So they are different things.
Yeah.
These are acting on Hilbert spaces. Right?
These are mathematical objects that act on Hilbert spaces.
On Hilbert spaces. So if it acts on Hilbert spaces, this is just, you are using the resolution of the vector. It's not like the previous one, in which you are using a fiducial set of measures we prepare.
I'm using the fact that that you can span the space using
right.
the product of the spaces.
These measurements are not like in the previous. I'm saying these double triangles are not like the single triangles. They act on the Hilbert space,
right, yeah,
not on operator space.
So the previous things were things in a laboratory. They were like boxes that you can
right.
buy maybe from a shop.
Yeah.
They were just diagrams of things, whereas these are mathematical objects.
So, and they act on Hilbert space, not on a space of operators on Hilbert space.
They act on Hilbert space, yes.
Okay, so
yeah.
that's enough.
This
is what Dirac called Brack.
Okay, I mean, fine.
Is it functional
right.
or the Hilbert space?
Right. Okay, yeah. So
right.
maybe we're just.
So this is exactly what.
But it's not this. It's not. It's not this kind of problem.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not like this.
This is H with index up. That's H with index down. The dual, which
right.
are since it's a Hilbert space, it's a dual.
Right, but these are not the objects I'm talking about. The objects I'm talking about are elements of. So they're not elements of the Hilbert space, they're operators on the Hilbert space. I'm not sure if there's some basic sort of difference in definitions that we have. I'm not sure if that's the case, or if it's a genuine misunderstanding.
So I'm trying to figure out the same thing. So let me test my understanding of telling it's wrong there. So if I took the Choi-Jelinkowski isomorphic operator to a given operation,
mm-hmm.
I'd say the operation would be from the operator that's on Hilbert space to the operator that's on Hilbert space.
Mm-hmm.
But the Choi-Jelinkowski isomorphic operator
mm-hmm.
now is on two Hilbert spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be something like, you know, from HA tensor HB to HA tensor HB.
Mm-hmm.
And in this formulation, you would write it as an A type coming into a double box and a B type coming out the top.
Right.
So I shouldn't think of it as, you know, taking you from the operator.
Yeah.
This
is a map that sort of lives on the product, on the tensor product space. You know, so it sits on top of it rather than mapping between and one to another. Yeah, and I'll yes. if I have time to try.
So then, roughly speaking, the left-hand side of the equation, I should think of that as an operator on, forgetting about superscripts and subscripts, HA, tensor HB, tensor dot, 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 tensor HD, tensor HD, etc.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly, yeah, absolutely. Maybe we can continue these later, because I'm sort of worried about time. Okay, so I get this equivalent thing for a complex subspace that looks very similar to the assumption I had. The structure is the same as full decomposability of operations, except of course I have a quality rather than equivalence. Okay. So then wires, I said I'd tell you what wires meant. So here's a place where I put a wire, I have a repeated integer here, the actual wire, and that means we have the product, not the tensor product, just the product, you take the two things and multiply them together, of these operators. So the product of an operator living in this space, an operator living in this space. So the order isn't important, so we have to adopt a convention. So I want to be able to say that this is equal to this. That just means whenever I see anything like this, I always, when I multiply it out, I put the one with the superscript on the left and the one with the subscript on the right. This doesn't actually matter. I could have adopted the other convention. It doesn't matter because I'm always going to be taking the trace, which doesn't care which way I multiply it. Well, these things, of course, are not emission in general. So this space isn't a space of emission operators in general. They do have real trace if you form them like this. Okay. So now let me just show you how to use. So you may have some fragment like this. It could be a more complicated fragment, and I want to know how to understand this object. Well, what I can do is I can insert the full decomposability relationship in like this. Then I can see what I've got is I can now understand this directly. This is just an object that lives in this space. So it's the sort of an object that lives in the tensor product space coming from each of the fiducial elements, except that in one place I've got a wire. So here I have this space. Okay. So generally a fragment operator is an example of the sort I just showed you. It's a case where you have many operators that have been wired together and you may have some open inputs and outputs. A circuit operator is where you've closed everything. So it's like this. And so a circuit operator is going to live in a space. So this, for example, this one lives in this space, where I've got every single subscript is matched by a superscript with the integer labels. Okay. And now we can try to proceed by analogy with previously. So rather than defining a P function, we define a T function. And the T function is defined like this, where these are all circuit operators, all things that have no wires left over. And then equivalence of two expressions means the same thing as before, except that now we're in this slightly different setting where we have the T function. And all the same kinds of things go through. So I've got an operator that acts in another space, and I take the trace.
Yeah, but you must have two interspaces, the input and the output, to make a trace. It must be a matrix.
If I write down an operator, I could just sum the diagonal entries.
But if it's a rectangular matrix, if it's a tensor, you can't take a trace of a tensor.
No, these things will not be rectangular matrices. They're just operators that act on that.
Like that one. So that's operator A.
Yeah. So I could take the trace of those things, but I never do. I never, for aesthetic reasons, take the trace of operators that have wires left open. I restrict myself only to taking the trace of operators that have no wires left open. I don't have to do that. But if you give me an operator, I can sum up the diagonal edges. That's fine. Okay, so this all goes through in the same way as before. And here's an example. So for example, this thing would be equivalent to this thing if it was true that every operator of this form, this side was equal to that side. And so for example, we have, under this notion of equivalence, an operator is equivalent to its trace. Just like here we had that an operation is equivalent to its probability. Here we have that an operator is equivalent to its trace. And the proof is similar to before. Okay. So if we have some arbitrary fragment, well, it's going to be an element of a space like this, and some of the integers, you may have some wires, some of the integers may be repeated. So in general, we can write it like this, where we take all the bit that's completed into a circuit out here, all the repeated ones are over here, then all the ones that are not matched are over here. Okay, so I've just written down my space as a tensor product, like so. Okay, I can do that. And now I define something called the circuit trace. So the circuit trace of any operator, for example, living in this space, is simply the partial trace over the circuit part with respect to this tensor product. Okay. So if I was to go back to this example, if I was to take the circuit trace of this object, then I would just be taking the trace over this bit, over this Hilbert, this part of the Hilbert space. Okay. So I write the circuit trace as C trace the dot. After taking the circuit trace, you have to have an Hermitian operator. And then also, if you consider the definition of equivalence, then it's true that if two fragments have the same circuit trace, then they're equivalent. That really follows pretty straightforwardly from the definition of equivalence. So again, equivalence is not the same thing as equality. But you could have two different fragments. One may have a lot of internal structure. The other one maybe not very much internal structure. But you trace over that, over the internal structure, the circuits that are inside. And if then you get equality, then it means that these two things are equivalent. So here's an example sort of relating to the question that Rob was asking. So I might want to think about a box like this. So this corresponds to an operator on this space. And imagine now sort of having something like this where I have an input. So this is some preparation coming from the input. I can get an equivalent fragment which consists of taking the circuit trace of this, so basically the trace over this part, that will give me, if I take the circuit trace, that will now give me an object which just lives in the output space. And so, in fact, you can define a map like this, the map that's given by this object, so that this map acts on some preparation and gives you an output operator. And this this shows you the relationship between the objects that I'm considering, this object, and the usual CP maps. I'll also show you the relationship between these and Choi-Chomolovsky operators. Okay. We can define a Hopping metric just like we did before. So here's, but now of course we have T because we have our new function. So a Hopping metric is defined like this. The inverse is represented by this. Okay, so now, just quickly, this shouldn't take too long, we can now reformulate quantum theory in this language. So we'll say that, in general, we'll say that operations correspond to operators if there's a mapping from operations to operators such that whenever you consider a circuit of operations, the probability of that circuit is equal to the trace of the corresponding circuit of operators. Okay. So if that is true for any circuit, then we say that we have correspondence between operators and operations and operators. Okay. And now we can see, actually, this is a very simple condition to satisfy. All we need to do is find fiducial elements for the operations and fiducial elements for the operators such that we get the same Hopping metric. If that's true, if the Hopping metric considered in the operations part of the talk is equal, so I found elements that is equal to the operations considered in the operator part of the talk, then you can see, well, this object is just equal to that, but now that object is equal to this. So by transitivity of equality, this is equal to that. Okay. So just a few points. So there's you can consider this kind of. So I wrote down all these operators. You can show that these operators have to be positive, and you can do that just by considering this kind of thing. And you can show that if you allow all arbitrary rank one projectors for preparations and results, for preparation operators and result operators, then this object is also proportional to any rank one projector living in the corresponding space. Okay. You can find projectors of this nature such that this is true. And so it follows that any operator you plug into this thing has to be positive, because out here you have any rank one projector, and so that thing has to, so this thing living in here has to be positive. A complete set of operations. Imagine you do an experiment and you have some operation. Associated with the operation is an outcome set, and you may have had other outcomes. If you take a set of operations which have disjoint outcome sets associated with that particular apparatus, and those outcome sets add up to the set of all possible outcomes, then we say that we have a complete set of operations. You probably have a better name for this, like test, is that right? And then we can also define a complete set of positive operators. So this is a set of operators satisfying a certain property that if you take the circuit trace over these operators where you put the identity on the output, okay, then you get the identity on the input. So this is you have a similar condition in the quantum combs paper. This is directly related. And elements, so there's elements in any complete set of positive operators have to satisfy a condition like this. And again, that's probably very familiar from the quantum combs approach. So here's the mathematical axioms for quantum theory. Axiom one, operations correspond to operators. And you can make that true if you can find equal Hopping metrics. And secondly, all complete sets of positive operators correspond to complete sets of operations. So that sort of, you know, a special case of that would be, for example, a measurement where the effects in the measurement have to add up to the identity. And this is a more general case where you have a more general operator with input and output structure. Here's a relationship between the this is the Choi-Jomolovsky operator written like this, and the relationship between that and the object I consider is given by this. So there's an equation relating to them. They're not the same thing, but they are related. And so one of the advantages of this approach is that if you consider so that the link product for putting together two Choi-Jomolovsky operators is given by this equation, but in this approach you have a simpler equation for putting these things together. If you want to find the equivalent object when you put together two things like this, then it's simpler. It just involves taking the circuit trace. There's no partial transpose and so on.
And to understand the correspondence, isn't the partial transpose included in the definition of the operators with the metric?
Obviously, since these things end up giving the same physics, there has to be some connection. But I think that these things are more naturally defined because they live on the object that's, I would argue, most naturally associated. They live on the mathematical object that's most naturally associated with the physical object. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe, and I don't know quite why we have such different equations, but I think that maybe it's because if you translate each of these objects into one of these objects, then back again, you know, you're introducing some extra structure.
Essentially, the equation 23 is probabilistic teleportation that you put to general cost. Choi Janukowski states in parallel and use the teleportation to probabilistically simulate the channel. So that's where the transpose goes.
Right. I haven't understood this connection.
Oh, yes.
Maybe.
Is it possible that you already have the transpose built in front of the distinct that the space is with lower index
I think that's got to be the answer, yeah.
I think you use the Yamakoski correspondence, which is different from the Choi one, because it's special transpose, right. But anyway.
Okay, so maybe you can talk about that. Sorry, maybe.
Am I right that the complete set of operators you find on the previous slide is that condition is equivalent to the condition that Matt described as the one that a conditional density operator has to satisfy, except your operators don't need to be to form a positive operator. But that, I mean, ultimately, when you pick a circuit trace and you put identity on the output, it's like taking a partial trace just over the output. In our case, you know, output is the thing that's on the left of the conditional, input is the thing on the right of the conditional, and if you trace over the thing on the left of the conditional, you get identity on the thing that's on the right of the conditional.
Yeah, I think, because you Matt said that was equivalent to the quantum Gödel's equation, the correspondence. I think they're all the same statement, just different sort of mathematical, just different ways of formulating the same statement, I think, yeah. I mean, I'm not 100% sure about that, but...
The figures, if I understand now, what you call operators are what usually is called map, right?
No, I don't think so. It's a map.
It's an operator anyway.
It's an operator, yeah.
Yeah, the point is that if you say that in actual 2 you specify positivity, but why you don't specify anything in action 1? So the operations are the physical one, right? The one that you can achieve in the lab, right?
Yeah.
There can't be any operator without any restriction.
So the operations are the ones. So the idea is that I go into the laboratory, I consider all the different things I can do, and I set the correspondence between operations and operators, with some appropriate mapping. And as long as I can do that in such a way that the probability is equal to the trace in the way I described.
Right.
And I say I have the correspondence.
But what is it? And the complete positivity. What is?
I think it ends up sort of. I mean, in your framework, the complete positivity is just in the positivity of the choice velocity operator. And here it goes into the fact that you have these positive operators. I think it's the same kind of thing. These aren't maps. I think I showed you earlier. A map is something like this that takes an object in. That's actually equal to the circuit trace of whatever you put here times this.
So these operators are the choice of the cost of it.
Sorry?
The operators that you put
in. No, these ones are not.
Are the ones that you put in the action?
No, these ones are these operators. Obviously. In the axiom, when I say operators, I'm talking about the operators. The operators I painted money. Yeah. The ones that have the structure I think is talking about. Just a few comments at the end. So you kind of get a unification of all the objects. You get this unification of all the objects that you have in quantum theory. So everything that you might consider states, effects, transformations, and even more generally, the object that you would want to naturally associate with fragments, they're all
described. As long as they're all described, I should say, or equivalent to, because you might want to take the circuit trace over them, equivalent to positive operators. You have a simple equation to put them together using the circuit trace. You have formalism locality. I didn't talk about that, but this is just the property that you can do your physics by referring to mathematical objects that pertain to arbitrarily shaped regions of space-time, or in the case of the circuit framework, arbitrary fragments. So you only ever have to talk about objects pertaining to those. You don't need to foliate. And I think this is sort of suggestive of an approach to quantum field theory. I mean, it sort of came out of this approach I've taken to quantum gravity, but I think it may feed back into that. It's very strongly related to the quantum Combs approach. It's also sort of related to the multi-time and the general boundary approach, except both of those approaches are for pure states, whereas this is for sort of a pure case, whereas this is for sort of more general mixed state case. And I put this in because I thought Bob would be here. It embraces his revolution. Okay, so that's the end of the talk. I went massively over, but yeah. Right.
Just the prompting operator.
Yep.
So what could you give, like, if you had a map with, say, one Kraus operator, how would it?
Yeah, I don't know.
So what does the unitary look like, for instance?
Yeah, I don't know. At least I have a GitHub corporate.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's also a rational projector. But I'm still sort of.
It'd be nice to see
some bit green
dynamical kind of examples.
Yeah, I think it's just. I mean, in the Choi Jonlowski thing, a unit operator is just corresponds to foster. It's just corresponds to rank one. I think it's the same here. This is the construction that seems to be what came out. Yeah. But they correspond to. And basically, if you take. An arbitrary unitary can be sort of set up like this.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe it's an extra stuff, but basically like this, where these things are.
I think it's just to play with it.
I don't fully understand all the details myself. I think I'm still a long way behind the quantum bonds guys.
It seems much nicer in some ways than the Choi Jonlowski. Because you don't have this partial transpose again. It seems much neater in that sense. It's kind of.
That's the advantage. But you may have disadvantages, like it may be harder, for example, to calculate one of these operators given the CP maps. I haven't worked out what that equation is yet. It's clearly very related to the two things. But it was very useful for my reconstruction because it enabled me to take a general circuit, and break it into elementary circuits consisting of just one effect. And so that was very useful.
Yeah. Just one other point. I didn't really understand what the benefit of the black and white dots were. Why couldn't you have always taken all the white dots on the left and the black dots on the right?
Well, you can, but you don't have to, and so you shouldn't. Isn't that just like...
What's the extra freedom you gain? Because it just seems like you're adding... It just seems more complicated if you allow yourself to... you can do all the things you want by always having white dots coming in and black dots coming out.
The sense I have is that then you're not looking at the full mathematical structure that's interesting here. See, can I get a better answer than that? Well, here's a better answer. If you just want to put together objects, directly without using the Hopping metric, then you're going to have to match black with white dots. So if I want to put together just directly a sort of bilinear equation that has, say, a preparation and an effect.
But I could always just have all inputs of white and all outputs of black, and then.
You can do that. That's true. But then on the other hand, if you now want to have, if you always want to be able to talk about your objects as having. Say only consisting of probabilities. So this gives you a probability representation. It has all black dots, and every element in an object is still a probability.
Your numerical coefficients are actually positive if you have it.
If you have all black dots, they're always probabilities. Yet you can't put objects with black dots together. You need some white dots to be able to match them up. Maybe that's the best answer. It's interesting though that once you get to operators, the dots drop out of it again. You don't need any black and white dots. So operators seem to do something clever, which is that they unify those objects on the same footing, and yet there's no need for different colors. You know, there's no need to sort of match dots. But there's only one standard representation. That's weird.
I wanted to ask a question about the contrast between the approach you're describing here and the approach that Giulio Maro Pali used.
Right.
And sort of approach that Matt talked about yesterday.
Right.
So it's still unclear whether if they really are sort of mathematically equivalent or whether it can be developed.
Right.
But suppose it were the case that actually they match up quite well, then but the interpretation of what's going on is quite different. So you're sort of taking an operational interpretation of all the structure, whereas I would say we're taking an epistemic interpretation.
Right. Yeah.
And so if I said, well, what's a good what should good axioms look like within our perspective? It would be statements about knowledge. So if learning A in the context of knowing B teaches you nothing about C, then symmetry should hold. Learning B in the context of knowing C should teach you nothing.
Yeah.
And things that have to do with conditional dependence and sufficient statistics and the language of statistics, and not things to do about what kinds of you know, the lithography and measurements and preparation of the math language. Anyhow, so I guess I'm curious, what would have to happen for you to start looking for axioms that were of epistemic flavor rather than operational flavor? Is it, I mean, just what are your thoughts on that?
So, I mean, so this was, like, I suspect that the framework that you and Matt have been working on is sort of richer in that it enables you to address questions I don't know how you would address. I don't know how you address the pooling question in this framework, other than just by going through the Royce calculations. It's not naturally built for that kind of question, and so that makes the stuff that you're doing more appealing in some ways. So I find that very interesting. And then, like, here I only have really one kind of object. The operations are just, you know, if you're applying this to quantum theory, the operations are constant systems coming in, constant systems going out. Like, you have also classical, you have boxes that correspond to some kind of classical thing. So that structure I don't have, and that's what allows you, I think, to consider these more general questions. So, yeah, so that's very compelling. It might be nice to try and work with this in that direction. I don't know. But the reason I came to this was actually I needed something to aim my reconstruction at. And this is very useful for that purpose, because it has this property that reduces a complicated circuit to a linear sum of a simple circuit. So that's the reason. There was no deep philosophical motivation or just sort of pragmatic sort of trying to find a way to do reconstruction. Opportunism, I guess. Motivations. Maybe I'm not sure. Maybe we should. We should probably continue sort of more informal.
Stop for the recorded part.
I'm not sure it's recorded, but if it is, we'll stop that part. It may not be recorded. Yeah.